Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
All right, it's the time of year where I remind you that if you do feel obligated to give gifts, you really couldn't do better than a pleasure check, the custom vouchers from the Pleasure Chest. From November 29th through December 31st, you can snag a pleasure check in stores for all purchases over $100. That's in-store only at the Pleasure Chests in New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago. For every $100 you spend, you get a $15 pleasure check. For every $150, you get $25. For every $200, you get $30. Offer valid on in-store purchases under $1,000, redeemable through March 31st, 2020. These can't be used for same-day purchases or combined with any other offers. And if you can't decide what to buy, either to earn your pleasure check or spend your pleasure check, why not try a holiday kit? These are available both in-store and online on PleasureChest.com. Far better than a novelty gift, they're assembled by pleasure experts to give you everything you want, all in one spot. If you are going to be shopping online on PleasureChest.com, check out the Snow Job Sale. Enjoy 10% off orders of $200 or more between December 3rd and January 1st. That discount is applied automatically at checkout. And don't forget, you can follow at Pleasure Chest Stores on Instagram and Twitter for up-to-the-minute info on these deals and much more from this sex-positive community icon. Ring in the new year with the Pleasure Chest. And now, on with the show.
Hello, and welcome to Why Are People Into That Live at the Pleasure Chest in New York City. Well done. I'm Tina Horn, and I spent the weekend at Comic-Con, so I'm a little under the weather, so I've got that, like, extra throaty, like, fluids, juicy, sexy thing going on, so you're welcome. I'm Tina Horn, and Why Are People Into That is my slutty, kinky, queer, perverted as fuck sexuality podcast. I've been producing and hosting Why Are People Into That 100% independently for over 5 years now. And in the past couple of years, I've been recording some episodes live in front of a studio audience, a subterranean audience, often right here at the sex-positive sex toy retailer, Pleasure Chest. Now, it is October, the nights are getting longer, and I wanted to dive into a little bit of darkness with an episode/edition of Why Are People Into That Live on Ritual. And the main difference between the regular Why Are People Into That podcast and the live show is that instead of choosing one sexuality topic, we cover a whole spectrum. And instead of one guest, I have two. So my guests today are Yin Q. Say hello, Yin.
Hello.
And Iona Pearl. Say hello.
Hello.
So let me tell you a little bit about them. Yin Q is a BDSM ritualist and educator, mother to two fierce children and two calm animals, and writer of Mercy Mistress, a web series based on Q's memoirs of coming into kink and sex work. Mercy Mistress is executive produced by Margaret Cho. Yin founded Kink Out to bring together intersectional peoples of the leather kink communities for art, conversation, and activism. Yin's writing is in Bust, Afro-Asia, Queer Magic, Apogee Journal, and the upcoming #WeToo anthology published by Feminist Press. They are currently working on a documentary on Red Canary Song, the sex worker organization that advocates for Asian migrant massage parlor workers. Everybody give it up for Yin.
Yin's social handles are at YinQ13, at KinkOut, and at Red Canary Song. Yin, I want to ask you a question. I'm going to put you on the spot because I didn't warn you about this because I thought of it on the train on the way here. I want to shamelessly promote my new comic book, Safe Sex, which is out now from Image Comics, while also praising your consulting skills. So one thing that's really amazing about being new to writing fiction is when you're a kinky queer pervert and you're writing like action adventure scenes, you can be like, okay, I have this character who is being arrested and I need her to like escape from the cops and like get out of bondage. But I actually am really lousy at bondage. Please don't tell anyone who's hiring me as a dominatrix. My bondage skills are pathetic. I keep trying and it just, I don't know if it'll ever happen. But anyway, but then luckily I do have people that I can call up or write and be like, Yin, you are a bondage expert. How would a character get really quickly out of bondage? And then I can like weave it into my story. So Yin, I would love it if you would tell folks like if they found themselves in bondage that they wanted to get out of, what are some techniques that they might use?
Yeah, I think I came up with like the funniest ones. I believe so. I mean, using Houdini's old tricks of actually slashing a little piece of part and hiding a key inside. Like a slab of skin, basically, and then part of your body that has been cut and kind of inserting it into your skin.
Did Houdini really do that?
I believe so.
That's so hot. Yeah.
Sadomasochistic max.
I think so, yeah.
I think I came up with some, like, well, first of all, if you eat a lot of salt, right, and you become extremely bloated, and then, like, the bloating goes down, I don't know, or something... What else?
Well, the one that I ended up using was hypermobility. And so sometimes people are born with hypermobility, but you were saying that you can train yourself to be hypermobile and that maybe also Houdini did that?
I believe that he was able to undo a shoulder. But yeah, I've definitely seen and I've played with people who they can just simply unlock a shoulder blade or like an elbow and be able to slip out of things that you don't think that most people aren't able to slip out of. So if you're double jointed and people don't know you're double jointed, then. And also there's ways of like actually flexing your muscles when handcuffs have gone on and then you're able to slip through them, which I have done.
So how does it make you, have you ever had a scene with someone where they're like kind of being a brat and they're like flexing while you're talking? Like, can you tell that somebody is doing that and that they're trying to like outsmart you or something so that they can wiggle out? And if they do that, how do you punish them?
Yeah, I actually talked to all of my bondage bottoms. If anyone who wants to like bottom to me as a bondage, I negotiate really, and I hit that point like hard. I said, if you want a Houdini, you have to wait until I tell you like go. Otherwise, like while I'm actually in the midst of putting bondage on you, you can't just start like wriggling out. I'm not going to like put up with you just like changing your body to kind of be up against it.
So that's not fun for you as a bondage top to sort of deal with somebody struggling.
No, because I'm not there to overpower them. I'm not looking there to wrestle them. I'm not in a wrestling play. No, I just want them to go into the bondage. And if they want to try and get out, then that's fine. And I've definitely put stakes on that where we've had, made that into a game.
What kind of stakes?
That's for another podcast.
Like if you get out of bondage, I'll make you a state.
Yeah, there's like lots of different rewards you can give to your submissive. It depends on like whether they're a client or whether they're a personal submissive.
Totally.
So you can imagine on the different the different wonderful things that can be offered.
Cool. Well, thank you for speaking to that, and thanks for being my bondage consultant. I'm sure I will have escape scenes that I need your help with in the future. Did you have a chance to look at the bondage that they have for sale upstairs here at the Pleasure Chest?
I looked at some of the things. Mostly I saw the ropes, which are fantastic. I love that all the different colors. I think that what kept coming, I kept looking at them were the chastity pieces. And I'm just curious. Yeah, I was just curious to see like what other kind of Lego pieces were coming out. Because I feel like every year there's always a new rendition of those chastity pieces. But they looked really interesting and new and fantastic.
Cool.
And then I really like, so like the bondage slings that are coming out, they kind of remind me of the yoga slings at the same time that I'm seeing online. So I'm wondering if you can like just get a bondage sling and basically do both things.
Why not?
You know, like you can do your aerial yoga, it can be the sex toy and the sex sling and yeah, everything else.
I was at a mutual friend of ours has a dungeon, and their landlord, this was recently, and their landlord was going to be coming by, and they were like, and they have this giant piece of custom bondage equipment, and they were like, I just threw some like aerial silks up there, do you think that this is gonna convince them? And we walked in and I was like, I'm totally convinced. And apparently the landlord didn't blink. So yeah, if you're looking to stealthily incorporate your custom bondage equipment into your house, just get some aerial silks and then maybe also you can do some exercising your day. I don't know, practicing on them.
Stretching. So many different ways.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So next up we have Iona Pearl, who is the assistant manager and sex specialist at the Pleasure Chest Upper East Side, which is where we are right now. They are a queer black femme and energetic Libra. We're in the middle of Libra season right now.
Next week is my birthday.
Next week is your birthday. Fabulous. Happy birthday. Iona Pearl is an abortion, contraception, and miscarriage doula and aspiring social worker. In their free time, Iona Pearl enjoys reading Sister Outsider, eating Sour Patch Children, and Crystal's Tiger's Eye. Everybody give it up for Iona Pearl. And their social is at Iona the Pearl. Iona Pearl, can you tell us a little bit about what it means to be an abortion, contraception, and miscarriage doula?
Yeah, I think that a lot of there's the misconception that a doula and a midwife are the same thing, but they're actually pretty different. Doulas generally will provide informational, emotional, and physical support to someone during a procedure, such as like having an IUD inserted, having a miscarriage or abortion procedure, or just having a consultation with their doctor. This was something that I started doing a couple of years ago through a great nonprofit organization called the Reproductive Health Access Project. Cool. I had an internship with them, and part of that was providing doula care in the partner clinic that they were involved in. It was a great experience. It was complicated in that it was a family health institute where people were being trained to perform these procedures, and it was also an institute wherein a lot of the people who were receiving care are people who are low income, folks who come from marginalized communities, and were receiving care from folks who were in training. So there was some complication around that, but it was a great experience.
Cool. Amazing. Thanks for speaking to that. So I am really excited today to talk about ritual, and I guess I'll start by asking you, Ian, I feel like you're somebody who was one of the first people who I became aware of integrating intentional ritual and like even using that word in their BDSM, both what you offer professionally and I know, you know, what you do in the sort of larger scale of your life. Can you just speak to what is the role of ritual in BDSM for you, and why are people into that? Like, why incorporate ritual into kink and BDSM play?
Sure. I think because during my sexual awakening and really going hard into sadomasochism and bondage, it was really sloppy. You know, I would just go in, sometimes not even with negotiations, and just really just, you know, out of nowhere, just like want to slap somebody or get slapped or just really egg someone on. And then once I found like the rules of BDSM to negotiate, even then ritual starts to seep into your play. But at the same time, you can sometimes with certain partners, you would just start playing and there'd be like no no circle or no beginning, no closure, to actually hold space and kind of create a session time for personal play. As I saw for myself, as I was playing with professionally, there was more intention of like creating the scene and sort of like taking it outside of your normal personal play exchange, and really like creating whether it's a role play scene or like really creating something that was going to have an arc to it, and curating everything about it in terms of like what music was going to be played, what's the senses that are going on, what kind of textures did I want to use during that scene, and then also what was the messaging, what was I trying to convey as a top, and what did I want from my bottom, and what did my bottom want from me, as I was playing that way professionally, I found more and more that that's what I wanted also for my personal play. And for me, going to see other DOMs and mentors as a bottom, I really was able to then find ways of like bringing the intention to move past certain things that in my life that I've had blockages with. So I'd bring things like my journals or my poetry or like any part of my demons from the past and just like bring them into the room.
Poetry so that demons.
Exactly. Oh, believe me. Some people have actually asked me to read their poetry to them while they're being flogged. And I'm like, yeah, I can understand.
The torture.
Like, if anybody read my poetry, that was probably...
Oh my God, like old Facebook posts, old MySpace posts.
Or like, yeah, teenage poetry. Oh my God.
Live journal.
I'm like, mercy, no, red. but no, just being able to bring in my demons and saying like, okay, this is something that I want to work on. This is what I want to get flogged out of me. Like, I want this beaten out of me. I want to be able to breathe it out. I want to be able to put it in front of me and really know that I'm working through this one issue right now. So for me, it was really seeing how that worked for me and feeling like it wasn't the end all be all of therapy. You know, it didn't make me like up the perfect person the next day, but it was able to like, I was able to release a lot of tensions around certain, you know, issues during different parts of my life. Yeah. And as I go forward, I find that like having those rituals really gives me that time, as I said, just to have a circle around the time that I'm spending with whichever partner I'm playing with.
It is amazing how, when you do have experience with sex work, you know, there's this misconception that there's a misconception that money takes all of the intimacy and all of the potential for connection out of sexuality, that the transaction, you know, cheapens it, that somehow introducing money cheapens it or empties it. But you are really speaking to something that I've experienced as well, which is the fact that sometimes money creates a structure and helps to set an intention and helps to create a negotiation, an agreement that maybe we're not taught as much to bring into our sexuality that our sexuality could benefit from.
Absolutely. I learned a lot from that.
From
that
money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What about you, Iona Pearl? Do you have thoughts on ritual and sex and BDSM?
Yes, definitely. I think that for me, ritual, a lot of it is about creating structure, like forcing someone when you're hitting them to like count the number of like strokes, or like if you're like, I love clothespins, I love pinching people, and I love to have someone like count out and like arrange in a very specific way the clothespins I'm going to use on them before I use them on them. But I also feel like creating, especially with someone who you like create a regular practice with, having those sorts of rituals is also like building a foundation of trust.
Totally.
And like familiarity, before going into like things that you like have talked about, but maybe not done before.
Absolutely. Let's start with solo play. Like, if we want to bring more ritual into our masturbation, self-love, self-care routines, where do we start?
Well, I think for me, it's about like giving myself that same love that I would to any partner, of like lighting a candle, putting on music that I want to listen to, putting on clothes that I want to like feel sexy in.
Yeah.
And this is like an elaborate masturbation scene is what I'm thinking. This is not your like, you know, super quickie before you go to sleep thing. Yeah. But it's, yeah, really giving yourself that time to then like set yourself up with whether you're going to watch a wonderful video or whether you're going to read an erotic story, putting all your toys out and kind of getting yourself into that headspace of like, okay, I want to go into that deep breathing and, you know, make sure that I'm hitting all of my spots so that I can like get that full body, incredible spiritual experience with myself.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes when we set more of an intention for our solo play and kind of treat it more like a date, it can help us to get out of our routine and sort of, I don't know, like I've found that I've had different kinds of experiences or different kinds of orgasms that I forgot that I could make myself feel. And I think that ritual is really good for that. What about you?
I like to create moods, particularly like with certain scents. Like I love lavender. So for me, that could mean like using a lavender soap, then like making sure I have lavender in my room, like fresh lavender particularly, or like also having like a sachet of it on me. Just like creating like a very aromatic atmosphere. Is something that's really nice and relaxing for me and kind of like gets me out of my head and more into my body a little bit.
Yeah, and they say that that scent is so associated with memory, and I think that just like a little bit of a spray of like lavender, or if you like rose, or I don't know, like bergamot or peppermint or something like that, like if you start to associate that smell with like solo play time or partner time or a group party or just like any kind of arousal, then just like a little spritz can sink you into that space in a really powerful way. And it's so simple and affordable.
Yeah. Something else I've been doing too, I think in the past 2 years, is using the Sletus tarot card.
Oh, yeah.
I love using those for solo and partner play in terms of just like, you know, just doing, pulling a tarot card, because the Sletus one always brings you like, I don't know, brings a lot of fun kink and personality into their tarot. So.
Well, let's talk more about incorporating tarot into your sex life. So wait, so what do? You like, you have a tarot deck and you pull a card, mm-hmm. and then where do you go from there? Like, is that an inspiration? Is it something that you are meditating on while you're jerking it?
Yeah, usually I'll pull a card. If I'm playing with somebody, then I'll have them pull a card. And usually it just sparks some kind of, you know, exactly as you said, just like inspiration, because it is just full of, you know, it's full of wicked fun. Like every character has like its own archetype, but with super erotic and free, I don't know, super queer superheroes in there. So
totally.
I always find it gives me some kind of insight, or like even into like whatever kind of role I want to kind of start molding myself into.
That's a great tip. I love that. Any other tips? Do you want to maybe expand into like partner play, like things to bring ritual into partner play, or how do we develop rituals that we share with our partners, and what purpose can those rituals play in creating intimacy or bringing a spark back into a long-term relationship or creating something special between certain partners? Like if you are non-monogamous and you play with a lot of different people, maybe like something that is a ritual that you only have with one particular partner that is special to the two of you?
Yeah, I think that like for long-term, because I've been in a relationship that's gone for, it's about 15 years now, I think it's just constantly molting, and it's and molding sometimes in the corner with some cheese, but and then you gotta get it out and, yeah, brush it off. And although the DS is always still strong, it's just about constantly finding something else that's going to energize our relationship. Like, just recently, we started reading over some of how other people have created these handbooks on DS relationships. And that's become part of our you know, we're having a monthly reading group. It's not that we're not necessarily taking everything or subscribing to everything the other people do, but just kind of getting this idea of like how other leather families have been formed, especially old guard leather families, and kind of like taking what we want from it. We were just recently reading the Jack McGeorge's leather family book, which is really based on a lot of military experience that he was, deeply involved in. And so that's been fun in terms of like kind of just incorporating those ideas. But then with ritual for people, I'm thinking of a particular partner that I'm just started playing with this past spring. It's sort of like we're recreating them as we go, but I'm still incorporating a lot of things that I've learned that work really well for me, or that I've really enjoy as a dominant, whether it's having somebody, you know, having them email me every week with like just a little weekly check-in to make sure that we're on the same page about certain things. I ask them for a lot of photos that I'm never going to share, you know, like, yeah. And there's a trust there.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah, so the question is basically, well, first of all, those are some really great examples that I would love for us to talk about on mic, but is ritual an umbrella term for protocol, and like what brings things into like a codification as protocol? But maybe let's define, what does protocol mean to both of you?
I mean, I think that I do think of ritual and protocol as fairly similar. I think ritual for me is a little bit more intimate, maybe. It also, ritual for me, I think of as less of like a rule than I think of when I think of protocol. I think of it as like very strict and like setting a certain expectation. Whereas ritual, I feel, is a little bit more intimate and like setting a mood, sort of, and like in an attempt to ensure a certain feeling. Not that you can ever guarantee that someone is going to feel a certain way, because you're doing something that you've done 6 times and they felt that way every time.
Yeah, and for me, protocol are the bricks of behavior that is expected. So if there's a DS relationship, there's an expectation and there's a training of saying, okay, this is how I expect you to regard me. This is how I expect you to stand in the room with me. This is how I expect you to walk, whether it's before or behind me. And then as opposed to ritual, which is a connective, which is very much like, this is how we are going to actually regard each other and interact, like a moment of connection that is is more heightened.
Yeah, I remember when in my first few years of being a professional dominatrix that I would do doubles with other ladies, and they would be maybe a little bit more what we might call high protocol, where they would have their submissive clients or their slaves. They would have to get into certain positions, and I was a little bit like, oh, this seems kind of corny, right? But then I started to try it, and I came up with my own little positions that were like somewhat based on ballet, like first, second, third position, and like somewhat based on like getting people into the positions that I wanted them to be in for the play that we were going to do. And I found it, it was incredible how like engrossing it was, that the minute that you start telling someone, I want you to stand exactly like this and like lift up your chest and put your hands behind your neck and then a few minutes later you tell them to, you say like, that's first position. And then a few minutes later you tell them to get into first position and they do it and they like, don't do it right. And you're like, oh, you're like training a dog, you know? And then you're like, oh, I get it. You're my fucking dog. and then like that, you know, that it works for me to get into top space. It works for them to get into subspace. And, you know, and then if you like are showing them off to somebody else, like you're taking them to a party or you're at a dungeon and you're bringing somebody else in, then you get to say, you know, show off your position. So like show off how well-trained you are, show off how obedient you are, show how devoted you are to me, that you show what a good listener you are. And it also separates the wheat from the chaff a little bit, because like sometimes people are like, ugh, I actually just came here to get fucked in the ass. I like don't want to like do your little like ballet positions. And you know, that's fine. But let's find out who you are by trying to put you through your paces, so to speak. And yeah, so that really, that's another thing that sex work taught me, was to be open to like observing things from the outside and not quite getting them, but then you try them and they can feel really different from the inside.
Yeah, I'm big on the positions. I'm very strict about the positions.
Yeah, tell us more about positions.
In terms
yeah.
of the hybrid protocol of four positions, I only use four because I figured like that's all I'm going to remember. Also, first position is like the child yoga pose.
Uh-huh.
Second position is on the knees but holding your hands outright as if you're holding a tray, so that I can easily lay down like my cane or my crop on their hands. But there's like on their knees but still kind of upright, and so you can still get to their nipples, you can get to their backside. And third position is standing up sort of in a military stance with hands behind the back but head gaze down. And then fourth position is on the floor, hands to the face, legs spread, so that it's this idea of like being able to get to any part of the body. And also I find that like if you tell them to go into a certain position, it is very much more like a military or any kind of conscious hacking of like what we want to go into, of like a meditative state, that if I say position two, they can go into position two and hold it. And it's almost like a strengthening of the will, you know, and giving them like a purpose, you know, their body, like it's letting them just surrender into their purpose of serving.
Well, and it does make me think of yoga asanas, where like you do the same poses over and over and over again in a lifetime, and you don't, you know, you're not going to get bored of them because there's so much in your subtle body that you're constantly adjusting, and you're also checking in with how your body and your consciousness feels different today than it may have when you did that position yesterday or a month ago or 5 years ago. And I can also see how certain those positions that you just described all have gestures and metaphors and moods to them, like being receptive or and the anticipation of a certain kind of activity. Mm-hmm. That's fun.
Yes. Like, and it's a position, mental bondage, which is also
right. Like, that's the other thing. If you tell someone to like, if position five is like on their hands and knees, or like on their elbows and knees with their ass in the air, it's like, you know, you're going to start getting in the mood to get fucked, you know, if you're lucky. Maybe. Well, let's talk about collaring, because our audience member brought up collaring. How can collaring be a part of a ritual or a protocol?
Collaring for me in my like kink BDSM practice is like a beginning, an intro. When I put this collar on you, that is the beginning of our dynamic. What I like about collaring is that it sometimes feels almost like an art, even though it's a very simplistic thing. Like if you have a pet, a dog, a cat, you put your collar on your animal, right? Like there is a gentleness to it sometimes, and there is a harshness to it. It also, I love that it really can like heighten anticipation.
Totally.
It makes me feel like myself and whoever is my sub are on the same page.
Yeah, it makes me think of that thing where you're in line at the coffee shop and you start to feel the effects of the caffeine, even though you haven't actually had any caffeine yet, because you know that the caffeine is coming and your body is like preparing itself for the caffeine. I feel like ritual and protocol can help with that. Like if a collar is being put on you, or you're being put in a certain position, or you're showering, or certain music is on, or you're smelling something, or somebody is wearing a particular article of clothing, or there's a certain sound that you hear, like the sound of their stilettos on the ground, like your body starts, you know, getting ready to receive discipline or receive, you know, a dick or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. Thumbs up all the way. I feel like collaring is definitely, can be super gentle. It can also be really rough if it's a metal collar. Depends on like, yeah, how it's done, but it can be a feeling of ownership. It's always a very loving practice, I feel.
Let's talk about group play, not necessarily like playing with a group, but maybe if you're like at a play party with a partner or partners and you're going to start a scene, what are some great rituals for beginning? And we've kind of been mostly talking about beginning, but let's also talk about closing a scene, because as I've talked about on the show many times, if you've ever been in a situation where your scene is interrupted or you're playing with somebody who is really, you're having a lot of fun and having a lot of connection, but they kind of don't really like bring it to any kind of meaningful conclusion, you can kind of be left hanging and it can kind of be an awful or confusing feeling. So let's talk about group play, and let's also talk about how we bring that narrative arc to its conclusion, to its denouement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I've being a fan of protocol, I do always have the submissive kiss my feet, or and also then ground with me. We do our, you know, because I usually start with breathing, breath work, and then I also end with it. And
can you give us some starting techniques if people have never used breath work in their play before? What's a good way to start experimenting with breath work?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really just, you know, using, well, if, you know, going to any like yoga class, which I'm pretty sure every New Yorker is done, has to do, right, before you come over the bridge or tunnel to get into Manhattan or Brooklyn. I feel like just being able to use that that warrior breath is a really good way to start the scene, so that you're sort of warming the body up, getting all throughout play, I tend to keep reminding the bottoms to breathe, especially if they're taking impact play, flogging. I'm always telling them to open up their chest and breathe out with the impact, so they can really feel like their body's a drum and able to like exhale anything that they want to get out of them. I think that breathing for me, in terms of a technique, something that I picked up from a friend that has really worked for me in terms of facing stress or anxiety, this is a good trick, is breathing in for four counts and then actually holding for four counts and then breathing out for six counts. And just the technique of doing that when I'm like by myself, after about three times, I'm able to like kind of get myself steady again. But that's not necessarily one that I use on my bottoms. I kind of want to get them like super hyper.
Well, but it can be like, imagine if you are having trouble processing pain, or if you like bondage, but you're in bondage and you're starting to panic. Mm-hmm. It can be a really great way to self-soothe or integrate or to demonstrate to your top that you are like mastering your own fear.
Absolutely. Also, like actually putting the hand, my hand sort of behind the back, behind the shoulder blades, behind the lungs, and just telling the person to breathe into my hand, and like so that they can actually feel their muscles and their lungs expand into my hand. I feel like that's always a good way to begin and end rituals.
Oh, that's so lovely and simple. It doesn't require any gear at all.
I usually start my scenes with someone kissing my feet. I also usually have my like implements laid out ahead of time, and I like to drag them along someone's skin, whether that be like clothespins, a flogger, any sort of impact, or just my fingers. Sometimes if I have long nails, I'm a very tactile person. I also like to whisper in someone's ear what I'm going to do to them. And breathing is something that I have trouble with in my own day-to-day life, but that I also have created protocols around with my subs, whether it be because I'm like doing something to them and I see that they're shaking and it seems like they're holding their breath, and I'm just trying to like keep them aware of their bodies and also make sure that they don't pass out. Yeah, breathing is a great one that I think a lot of people like. There is a lot of people talk about it, but it's still something that we like fail to be conscious of a lot, I think.
So what are some great closing or aftercare rituals?
Making me food. A good meal, tea, somebody making me tea in a ritualized way, offering tea, offering a bath, offering massage. I always feel like is a really great way to have like an aftercare, and then also then having that time to have a little bit of decompression. I'm not, depending on the scene, I don't always want to go into processing right away. And sometimes I actually need departure, you know, from the person to be able to process and to allow them to process. And sometimes I like to hear their processing later in email because I like to savor it by reading it since we love literature. It's romantic. For me, it's about like even just putting the toys away as a top.
Cleaning
the toys, yeah. Right, exactly. Putting things away, getting myself back down to sort of into my own skin again, coming down off the endorphin high, but making sure that I'm being fed by the other person as well, like either through food or food.
Tops or need food. Aftercare too, people.
Clean up. But before that, I mean, it really depends on what my dynamic with the person is. Like if it's someone who is like my sub, who I collar, sometimes that means like uncollaring them at the end of a scene. Sometimes that means someone is cleaning the bottoms of my feet or cleaning my feet. That can also be like cuddling, depending on my relationship with the person. I think something that I've been running into some difficulty with recently is how to have good aftercare with someone like at crowded parties.
Yeah.
Like finding space for aftercare can be kind of difficult, especially when there's the endorphin rush, both from your scene, but just from the general atmosphere.
Totally.
It can be hard to come down from that.
So do we have any tips for good aftercare in overstimulating parties, especially if, like, I don't know about y'all, but I've definitely been to parties where you like finish a scene and like the person, they like have a date and the other person is like standing there with like all the gear for the next scene and they're like waiting in line. And it's like, how do you bring things to a close when there's like pressure to move on? Or when you're just feeling like what you want is to feel alone with that person, but you're surrounded by people.
I don't think I'm the right person to answer this because I don't go to parties anymore. I'm in bed by 10. the few times that I go to parties, if I want, you know, to actually connect with somebody, then I need to leave that space and actually then sort of have, even if it is just like going outside of the doors, having it be a little bit more quiet and just having that time to like have that person show me their gratitude and then me be able to give them a hug.
Yeah.
Before I
sometimes
go
a hug
off
is
into
all
the
it
night.
Takes.
Yeah. But I'm also not, I don't do a lot of, to be honest, I don't do a lot of pickup play at parties anymore. But when I did, it would get sloppy. I'd have to like call the person the next day for sure. I'd always text, you know, or back then talks to call the person and just be like, hey, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Just want to make sure you're okay. And that would be my aftercare, was just making sure that person had gotten home safe.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the topics that Yin brought up when we were discussing what we were going to discuss today was like generally put the topic of asexuality through kink or asexuality except for kink. And I'm wondering if you can speak to just in general why that topic came up for you.
Yeah, I think to put that in context, we were talking about the long-term relationships and I was kind of thinking about kink has often come in not just as sexual, but also sometimes in place of sexual interaction for me. Because I've gone through motherhood, I'm in perimenopausal life now. Hormones sweep ups, hormones sweep down, careers, you know, projects, art. Creating art is also really about birthing and
totally
fucking the world so that we can birth more. And sometimes my you know, appetite for flesh on flesh sexuality is not always so vibrant because it's just being in my art or in my womb or like in, you know, with other things, other creatures in my life.
Are you just fucking so tired?
Yeah, exactly. So that's where I feel like kink has always been really strong, though. Like, it's never wavered. I've never felt, like, not kinky. I've definitely felt, like, not feeling sexy.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, or not feeling sexual, rather, and not feeling sexy. And those two can go hand in hand. And but I've never felt non-kinky. I've always felt like, you know what? I might not want to fuck you, but yes, I want to put you into bondage and beat you. Of course, you know? So that's almost like really been sort of a reliable pillar in my life of being able to keep connections with certain people, especially long-term, that I've been able to, you know, it's constantly changing, yes, but there's always just been sort of like, we can go back to this because this is something we know and we really rely on and it's pulled us through.
I think it's a really, I was so glad that you brought it up because obviously there's lots of different ways to be asexual, and some people are asexual, some people are aromantic, some people are demisexual, and there's all kinds of really, really great conversation going on about these different identities, and I think that it's really beautiful. And I'm not asexual, but I do find that I have distinct, like, kinky desires for some people that I'm not necessarily, like, sexually attracted to, and that has been a really big change in maybe like the past like 10 years of my sexual life, that being able to relate to people in a like quote unquote platonic way, but in a very kinky way, is very fulfilling. And it kind of, it's for me like an expression of non-monogamy. And it is also nice to recognize that as we age, as we experience different stressors in our life, whether it's our career or our art or breeding or whatever, that as our bodies change, that we can have long-term relationships with people, that we can relate to them erotically in lots of different ways. And I think it's a possibility of BDSM that doesn't get talked about enough. I think we talk a lot about like the excitement of BDSM, where we talk a lot about like, did you know that you can do these kinky things by the stuff at the pleasure chest, which you should, by the way. But we don't talk about it as like a way to integrate intimacy and like different kinds of erotics into our lives. So I'm glad that you brought that up. I'm wondering, do you have anything to say about that, Iona Pearl?
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying about like there being people in your life who you aren't necessarily attracted to in a our traditional ideas of like, I'm attracted to this person, I want to have sex with this person, but also having kinky desires around them. Definitely. What really how BDSM has changed my life too is really challenging my idea of like what sex is, or in general, like what is important to me about my kinky sex life, which involves people who I have like no attraction to, but am like very, have extremely intimate play with as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the pet play, which I've just recently gotten a new human puppy. And I've never actually gone down that route in terms of being a handler before. And interestingly enough, this year I've handled both kitties and puppies. And I just wanted to, as a handler or new handler, and I've done so many different other kinds of play, but for some reason, like handling, I've just never done. But I realized that my persona as a handler is not a sexual one. Like, I don't get turned on by the puppy. I really enjoy having the puppy go into an asexual and very safe space.
Yeah.
And it's almost just like a, it's almost just like a purely nurturing one. I mean, one that, you know, requires training and obedience training as well, but not, and but I'm not going to beat my animal. I'm not going to fuck my animal in that space. Yeah.
I mean, I think that the most important takeaway from this is that if there is something kink-wise that you are interested in, either because it's something that you, it's gear that you see at the pleasure chest that catches your attention, or you've listened to Why Are People Into That and you've heard somebody talking about a particular topic, it is completely up to you and your partner or partners and or partners what kind of style you, what kind of erotic style you want to have. For some people, the BDSM that they're into always is going to involve fucking and orgasms and penetration and that kind of connection. And for some people, it never does. And for some people, it does with some people, but not others. And some, it, you might find that it changes in different times in your lives, or there might be some activities that you feel, some kinky activities that you feel extremely erotic about, like you want to incorporate fucking into them, and some that you don't, and it's totally up to you to decide at every moment. Isn't that great?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go from having like a bodily orgasm to a braingasm to like a masochism. All kinds of orgasms out there.
What is a masochism?
Like a masochist orgasm, you know? Like
some, I know, people, yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. When somebody's going into that like incredible like pushing that threshold of pain again and again, and they just get into that point of just blissful flight.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay.
A lot of the time when we talk about ritual and BDSM, there's either a sense that we're invoking some sort of magic, which is something that we've talked about on this show quite a few times, but also healing. And I think that there's a lot of really powerful and beautiful conversation happening right now in our culture about using BDSM to heal. But I also kind of want to complicate that a little bit and talk about, like, in what ways is BDSM good for psychological and emotional healing, and in what ways do we need to incorporate other kinds of therapeutic modalities and not lean on BDSM 100% to solve all of our problems. Can you guys speak to that?
I really wanted to speak about this because a lot of my work has been talking about BDSM as healing, but I also really wanted to stress this point that it's not the end all be all. Like, it's not like that I've gotten to BDSM and now I'm like a healthy whole, like completely contained and you know,
enlightened.
Exactly. Person. It helped me grasp a lot and also then like really helped me care for myself so much through, and also really be able to, you know, going into BDSM rituals gives me the chance to really hold myself as a sadist and as a masochist and as all of the different parts that I've always struggled with when I was younger. However, things like anger still comes up. You know, I still have issues with anger, which I had to find other kinds of rituals and I had to find other kinds of healing modalities to really understand what that was all about. Because I had thought about this for a while, I thought that going into BDSM had helped me contain all of my anger management issues. And then, like, you know, as I came out of the profession, I realized that I'd been in this profession for so many years that actually encouraged that endorphin high again and again and again. But then when I wasn't hitting that endorphin high again and again after, you know, coming out of the profession, I realized that, like, oh, I've got this whole lot of, like, addiction issues to that dopamine rush that I need to now, like, figure out as you know, a plebeian on the streets with no sub to hit. You know? And so it really was about, like, looking at therapy, at breathing techniques, at yoga, at almost everything, and really, like, discovering all over again, like what I needed for those kinds of issues.
Well, thank you for speaking to that. I think that sometimes there's a tendency when we come across something that goes against the mainstream or that is an alternative modality, we feel like eureka, and we feel like all the things that everybody has been telling us is a lie and this is the path, this is the solution. And there's a lot of dopamine and excitement and also like a sense of revelation, not to mention like, you know, fuck the man, like elements to it. And I think, unfortunately, I don't want to take anything away from that. I think that that's very real. And yes, and I think that we do also have to get to a point where we have to realize that it's lifelong work. You're not just going to like get solved by like one really good beating and then being beaten by that exact same person and that exact same way is always going to work, there's a lot of narratives of like, there's a lot of pathological narratives around BDSM and the idea of sex addiction and the idea that like, if you like get used to something and then it doesn't work anymore, it's like, because it's like a drug that isn't working anymore. And actually what I think that what you're saying speaks to is that the best kind of healing integrates so many different forms and so many different kinds and an acceptance that it is lifelong work. And BDSM can be a really powerful part of that.
So I came into BDSM or my interest in, or I mean, I guess I definitely like was kinky before I experienced sexual trauma, but that was really like the impetus for me seeking out a community. I had this idea that like if I had what I think is like a very like common stereotypical idea that if I was a top, then no one could hurt me.
Oh, yes.
which isn't the case. I felt like I was a little bit out of control and like I needed some structure, and that having like creating protocols, having structure, going into a relationship with someone and already there being an expectation that we would talk about boundaries and we would talk about limits, and that would be like an open discussion that was expected, was something that I was really searching for and that I found, but I think also should go for like all types of sex, all types of play, all the time.
Thank you guys for speaking to this really hard and sensitive topic. I have had the experience recently of doing some coaching and feeling like in some ways like institutionalized medicine and institutionalized mental health has failed us so much. So like community-based like coaching and healing has been such a powerful alternative. And then sometimes I find as like, as somebody who is doing that coaching, I feel like, am I like failing this person because I don't have like training or a license. And, but then I think like a lot of people who have training and licenses are full of shit. I don't know if any of you have met any of those people, but I have, and I want my money back. I think something really beautiful that's happening is that a lot of people that come from queer communities that are also able to be out in their work as being kinky and coming from that experience and that space are then going to university and going into institutions and getting their licenses and offering healing that is explicit about that and that is explicitly like inclusive and welcoming. And so I'm just happy that that is happening, because I think that again that integration is what we need.
Yeah, and I'd just like to plug in for Manhattan Alternative.
Yes.
Is a site to find a lot of different clinicians of different kind of practices, a lot of mental health practitioners, but also Reiki practitioners and yeah, acupuncturists and I think even physical trainers, who are not only just kink aware but kink educated, And it's really important to seek that professional out because, yeah, I've gone through my gamut of like so many professionals whom I'd then have to educate and I'd still get judged back.
Totally.
So, yeah, Manhattan Alternatives.
Yeah, and the Gender and Sexuality Therapy Collective as well are is a really great resource. Shout out to them. I think I want to give like 5-10 minutes to open up to the room if anybody has any questions about anything that we've talked about today. Does anybody have any questions? Yes. Brilliant question. Thank you. So the question is about using language in ritual. It's really bananas, actually, that I haven't brought this up since that is totally my thing. I was actually thinking about words, Yin, when you were describing how you wax and wane in how much like flesh on flesh sexual desire or interest you may have, but you like are always interested in bondage. And I kind of feel that way about dirty talk. And it feels really nice to be in a place in my life where I don't feel like a little bit of dirty talk and snuggling is like a consolation prize for instead of sex. It actually feels like sex. It doesn't feel like sex. It is sex for me. And it feels really nice to recognize it as that because then I'm coming at it from a place of abundance instead of scarcity. But that's my sexuality. I'm a very language-based person. And the question is about words and ritual and protocol. I absolutely think that, you know, if there is an honorific that you have for someone that you only call them when you are playing together, and that might be daddy or it might be mistress or it might be sir, that also can have the same effect as an aroma or a certain kind of music or a certain space or a certain outfit of really sinking into that role. And also, yeah, maybe certain words that you use to describe someone in like a complimentary way. And I also find that there are certain tones, like either authoritative tones or like flirty, princessy tones or whiny tones that like tend to only come up when I'm playing with certain people. And that can be really intoxicating and ritualistic. Like if you're like using that tone, you know, you're asking for it and you're probably going to get it. What do you guys think about language and even like just like any use of verbiage mm-hmm. for ritual?
Yeah, I think language is really important, especially since we were talking about this before. My verbal communication during play is usually very limited. I like to go into like very quiet zones of sadism, and that's sort of like where I use use tension as, you know, and silence. However, then I'm very scarce with my words, but I'm also very, like to be very exacting with them. So in terms of negotiations, before play, I really go through what the person likes to be called for both praise, for both and sexy humiliation, what terms they want to use on their body, on their genitals, on their chest, all different parts of their bodies, like how they want to it for it to be named, gendered, whatever, so that I know what makes them feel good. Because I
or feel bad.
Right, or feel bad in a great way. Because I feel like that there's, you know, I've definitely gone into play or seen play where certain words come up and it just disrupts the entire scene. You know, and I've definitely seen that. I've definitely felt that for myself. I always kind of talk about how like the word stupid for me is like not sexy as a top or a bottom because I was a younger sibling. And so it brings up a lot of PTSD from those years. And so it's like that word that like seems so banal or silly can really just trigger somebody to be like, oh yeah, all right, we're done. Let me go catch a cab.
Or and it can seem like such a slippery slope from like you could love being called worthless and then somebody calls you stupid and you're like, whoa, no, I lost my boner.
Just that one, yeah, slight step to the left of whatever the
word is. But everybody's different.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And you might surprise yourself also in life, like what you might
be open to it, at being open and flexible to change is an important part of knowing what your desires and boundaries are.
Mm-hmm. And then, and also I have protocol for how my submissive is to address me when I'm in scene, and then how they're to address me for like a social situation. And then also even written how I want their the title to be, for me to be addressed even through titled of emails or text messages.
Yeah, I also am scarce with my words during scenes, but when I do speak, I tend to be very intentional about the words that I'm using, the way I'm addressing the person I'm playing with. I'll always make sure to talk that through with them ahead of time, because there's nothing that like stops a scene quicker than someone like calling you the wrong thing. Or like using words that someone isn't comfortable with.
Yeah, great question. So the question is basically, we've talked about ritual for opening and closing scenes, but what about using ritual within the scene? Do you guys have tips?
Yeah. So there's certain types of ritual play where I will actively curate the actual scene with the person, especially if they're going into a ritual of ordeal or a ritual of where they really want to face some kind of trauma. Anything where somebody is facing demons or trauma, that person has to actively be part of the making of the ritual. For me, this is how I guide those kinds of play, that I am not dominating over them during that time when we're facing trauma together. So if somebody's going through an ordeal path, of trying to face some past demons, then we really write it out. We decide what elements are part of it together. And it's really that I give that, like, open it up to whatever their spiritual beliefs are, whatever their energetic beliefs are, whatever they really find meaningful to have in the room with them. And so that there can be mantras, there can be me reading their poetry to them while they're in bondage. I need to know if they go into bondage, if they want to go into an extremely quiet zone of going into very meditation space. If it's going to be a ritual where there is a DS relationship, then I won't necessarily give them that ability to have control over their ritual, except for just giving me the sort of like a set, their set interests and their set, boundaries. But the ritual would be consist of things like mantras, things like counting strokes, and different kinds of games that are rituals, that are ritualized, such as holding facing the wall, holding the something up to their nose, and they're not allowed to let it fall while I'm flogging them. And if they let it fall, then they get punished more. I mean, those kinds of rituals are like games that you can play that are sort of like just give the scene sort of like a purpose.
I would also kind of, to add on to that and the previous question, I think having someone say thank you throughout can be like part of a ritual. It can be a protocol. It can be like a way of centering the scene, centering someone and centering yourself, and remaining present, I think, is really important. I like it when people say thank you.
Yeah, I love, you're generating gratitude. It's really nice. I think we have time for one more question. Yeah. This beautiful question is about if your body is going through any kind of change, or if you are experiencing any kind of change that could be gender transition. It could be any kind of gestation. It could be any kind of grief. How do you incorporate ritual into that life transition? Do you guys want to speak to that?
Yeah, so I've done held space for people who are transitioning, and often it looks like a self-birthing, where I give them a chance to either go into bondage or be held by community space. Sometimes it's using piercing playing, sometimes it's using just all different kinds of BDSM elements, but it's this idea that this person is remaking themselves and giving themselves the chance to steer where their transition is going, and marking that as a momentous time, because there's so many things that, like, in our, I guess, spiritual paths that have been kind of washed away. We don't have that many, you know, coming of age traditions anymore that are really personal to us anymore, I guess. Some cultures have, like, you know, sweet 16. Chinese, we have, like, this 12-year-old birthday is really important. But I feel like those things are sometimes getting lost. So anyone who's going through transition, I give them a chance to actually create that self-birthing. And sometimes it's with their friends, and sometimes with other people around them, yeah, or just another partner.
Yeah, I love the idea of inventing our own rites of passage. But I also like the idea, I feel like your question touches on the idea that if there's some consistency as we change, that we, like, feel ourselves changing, but then we're, like, ritualistically coming back to something over and over. And maybe it's a song, or maybe it is a ceremony of some kind, or maybe it's a ritual of self-care, like a bath, or maybe it's some new article of clothing that is, like, grounding us and reminding us that even as we change, there's something fundamental to who we are that we can continue to return to, but then also integrate.
I identify as non-binary. I have a different relationship with my body every day. I experience a lot of anxiety around my gender and just day to day. But something that has been great for me recently is, like, getting tied. Even though I experience that as, like, something is happening to my body, it also is, like, has been a very, like, meditative way for me to, like, be in my mind and out of my body enough to, like, appreciate the experience that I'm having. I don't know that answers your question exactly.
But. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I think bondage is a great way to, or a great ritual to go back to again and again for grounding, especially if you're feeling out of your body, or, like, or that, like, so many things are changing that you're, because it does hold you in your body. I know that for PTSD, a lot of people use those heavy blankets.
Oh, yeah.
To be able to sleep, to calm anxiety. And it's the same idea, and the same as yoga, this idea of actually just really settling into your body, using breath work to go into your body. I feel like bondage, whether it's rope bondage or leather, full leather bodysuit, is a really wonderful way to just sort of, you know, keep yourself in.
Yeah, like containment.
Contained in utero. I mean, there's just so many metaphors for it, but really.
Or even, like, accepting, like, the inevitability of death, when perhaps you will be in the cold, cold ground, yeah, contained by the earth.
It's a very calming thing. I mean, even when I'm teaching basic bondage, there's so many people who will all of a sudden just be like, oh my God, I feel so sleepy and, like, calm. And I'm like, yeah, that's the beauty of bondage. It's it can do so many things. For some people, it totally excites them and they're ready to, like, get fucked. And some people, they're just like, oh no, I just want to go get snuggly and, like, you know.
It's like a hug that goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Well, bondage may be the hug that goes on and on, but this podcast must unfortunately come to a close. That is all the time we have for today. I want to give a shout out to my loyal live sound engineer, Ben Weber. Everybody give it up for Ben. As always, I want to thank the Pleasure Chest, especially Ryan and Bahar, and of course my guest, Yin Q.
Can I do a plug for the events?
Oh yes, plug away.
Oh yeah. So Kink Out and Red Canary Song are both of which I'm part of are producing a big event on November 2nd at Lot 45. Please come out. It's an all Asian American burlesque, drag, and kink extravaganza, but everyone is welcome to come as guests. And there's going to be tattoo silent auction by some amazing tattoo artists throughout the city, mostly Asian Americans, but plenty of others, allies as well. And this is to support Red Canary Song, which is the sex workers organization that supports and advocates for East Asian migrant massage parlor workers, especially the ones in Flushing. yeah, who have been really raided and I don't know, targeted by the police as of late. And then also over January, February, Kink Out will also be at PS1 MoMA. So please come out to all of our wonderful events out there, too.
Hell yeah. And do you want to talk about Leslie Lohman as well?
Oh, yeah. Right now there's a queer sex workers art exhibit going on called On Our Backs. And we will be actually doing a panel there with the lovely Tina Horn moderating.
On November
19th.
My brains.
November 19th with Ashley Page, Sir Malicious, Christian, and Nashawn Dion Anderson, myself, and Red from Blue Stockings.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being here. And let's also give it up for Iona Pearl. Iona Pearl works right here at the Upper East Side, Second Avenue Pleasure Chest. So is there anything in particular that you like love to talk to shoppers about?
Our free workshops every Wednesday from 8 to 10. We have at the Pleasure Chest... Education is a really important part of the work that we do. So offering these free workshops every Wednesday is really important.
Do you have any workshops that you're teaching that are coming up?
I think I'm teaching an Awaken Your Senses class some point in December.
Awesome. Well, pleasurechest.com/events is where you can find out the info on all of the upcoming free workshops. And as always, you can subscribe to Why Are People Into That wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow me at Tina Horns Ass on Twitter and Instagram. Please support the decriminalization of sex work wherever you can, and do what you can to destigmatize whores, sluts, perverts, and queers. Everybody go enjoy your 15% off shopping. The store is open till 10. And thanks for being here.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.